Hi, welcome to this week's program.
Winter is coming.
Might just be the cold.
Winter is coming.
It's cold outside.
You don't know cold.
Winter is coming for him.
It's either me or this cold, and it doesn't appear to be going anywhere.
And winter is coming.
You look cold, boys.
It is a bit nippy.
Winter is coming. Winter is coming.
Since the dawn of human civilization, the jostling of economic and military power has relentlessly shaped human history, and writers have often dipped into this rich vein of history to build their characters and plot lines. And so it is with the very popular, award-winning HBO series Game of Thrones, which offers its own insights into how kingdoms are won and lost. And I want to give credit to Michael Estrin, contributing reporter for Bankrate.com, who laid out some of the financial lessons from Game of Thrones that I plan to talk about today. But first, let me fill you in on what the series is all about. Game of Thrones is an adaptation of a series of fantasy novels called A Song of Ice and Fire by American novelist George R.R. Martin. The first book in the series is titled Game of Thrones, which is where the TV series gets its name. The drama plays out on the fictional continents of Westeros and Essos, and the quest for the Iron Throne of the Seven Kingdoms through a web of alliances, deceit, inheritance, and conflict among dynastic noble families vying for the throne or fighting for independence from it. That's a very brief overview, and if you want to learn more, just Google Game of Thrones and you'll find everything you want and more. In the series, money plays a very prominent role in determining the fates of warring sides. So, keeping in with the theme of this show, let's talk about a few financial takeaways from the Game of Thrones. Winter is coming. That's the ominous title of the very first episode, and those words are uttered by a father in response to a mother worrying about her young son, Bran Stark, who had just witnessed an execution. But you immediately know the father is talking less about the weather and more about the hard times ahead and would rather his son be prepared for much worse that's yet to come. And so it is with all of us. Sooner or later, we will face the winters of our lives when we get old, and it is best that we prepare ahead and start saving and investing for retirement at the youngest age possible. As I mentioned in a recent commentary, an alarming number of Americans are ill-prepared for retirement. So make sure you're not one of them when you head into the inevitable winter of your life. Here's another quote. A Lannister always pays his debts. Now that's a reference to the House of Lannister, one of the richest and most powerful families in Westeros. And the financial lesson from Game of Thrones on this one is that you're always better off keeping a lid on your debts, paying them on time, and never taking on more than you can afford. While some debts, such as a mortgage on an affordable house, can be helpful and even serve a good purpose, many other debts are bad, so stay as debt-free as possible. With dynasties jockeying for power, long-term outcomes strongly depend on the lines of succession and the strengths, weaknesses, and follies of heirs. As Game of Thrones fans know all too well, those who wear the crown aren't always the best candidates for the job, and things can go really badly when you don't designate responsible heirs ahead of time, because death can come at any time in Westeros. So our takeaway here is that estate planning is absolutely essential. Studies show that most Americans don't even have a will or an estate plan, even though it doesn't cost a lot to set one up. So make sure you have a will and a trust in place, and it will give you peace of mind should something happen to you, and will cleanly and immediately transfer those assets to your heirs without legal expenses, probate fees, and months gone by before heirs can actually touch the assets. All right, next, be certain your trust is well placed. In Game of Thrones, there's a heavy undercurrent of betrayal, and no character, no matter how powerful, is immune to a good double cross. Well, fortunately, our world is not so Machiavellian for the most part, and we have laws and rules in place to protect us and our finances. But even so, stories of financial betrayal abound. In fact, I recently did a piece on Johnny Depp suing his financial management firm after a 17-year financial relationship. And whether the firm was at fault or not, it's important that you pick your financial advisors, accountants, estate planners, and will executors that you can trust. And remember, if you are on top of your finances, it's harder for someone else to betray you, and if they do, you'll catch them before it's too late. Now here's another financial lesson from the Game of Thrones. The phrase, "it's a big world," refers to two major threats to the Seven Kingdoms, from White Walkers to Targaryen dragons, that remain largely unseen by many of the characters in the series who don't realize the potential havoc they can cause. So it is with external events in the investment world. While we cannot control a lot of the unknown unknowns, remember that phrase? We should stay informed of faraway forces that might impact our lives and wallets. Whether it's a European debt crisis, economic pressure from China, or something else, stay abreast of outlier threats to your portfolio and seek shelter if you see a wind blowing that could develop into a storm. Let's talk about women. Women's work is undervalued in the Game of Thrones. While women acquire wealth and power, respect doesn't come easily in Westeros, and they're often mocked even when their talents are at par with men. Today, qualified and hardworking women still earn less than men in similar positions, so we should all realize that women are as much a resource as men and treat them fairly without prejudice, respect them, and pay them at par with men. Another lesson from the Game of Thrones, you need a disability carrier. In the series, our young Bran Stark has a steep fall and is unable to walk again. From that point on, Bran relies on a slow-witted giant named Hodor to carry him around. In that fictional world, there is no disability insurance, and without Hodor, Bran would have been stuck in one place. So while it's important to have health insurance, it's also a good idea to have some form of disability insurance. According to the Insurance Information Institute, about half of all large and mid-sized U.S. employers offer some form of long-term disability coverage, so check what your employer covers. And if you feel that coverage won't be enough, consider buying private disability insurance, especially if you're the sole earner in your family. Well, there are still more financial lessons from Game of Thrones. For example, Westeros does not have a single bank, and its kings must borrow from the Iron Bank of Braavos. When princes fail to repay the Iron Bank, new princes spring up from nowhere and take their thrones. Real power lies with the Iron Bank, not the kingly borrowers. Also, real estate is another valuable asset. Without land, you are of little consequence in the Game of Thrones, and dispassionate kings prevail over those who let emotions get the better of them. And so it is with our investments, where dispassionately sticking to a plan works wonders. So there you have it, a few financial lessons from Game of Thrones that can help you make your private kingdom even more powerful.
Winter is coming.
I'm cold.
It's cold and it's wet.
Winter is coming.
You're crying because you're cold?
You're a long way from home. Winter is coming.
I imagine you might be rather cold.
And winter is coming.
No, that's all right. I'm fine.
You're not. You're freezing.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. My next guest is Matthew Lundy, Esquire. He was born in South Florida, and he's developed a reputation as having a special skill for handling complicated legal issues. Matthew has published scholarly articles and conducted seminars for judges, attorneys, and other professionals. He's been honored as a rising star by Super Lawyers magazine and an outstanding young lawyer by the American Registry. But he specializes in an area of law which pertains to certain complexities within divorce. And this is why I've asked him to join me today. I wish him to talk about one area in particular, and it's an area of something called the Qualified Domestic Relations Order. Welcome to the show, Matt. Finally got you in here after two other attempts. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So this is an area of law that if you do get divorced and you have a retirement plan, this word comes up a lot. The nickname is the quadro, and as I said before, the Qualified Domestic Relations Order. What is a quadro?
A quadro is basically a court order that's entered in a family law case that divides a retirement plan. That's the short answer to that question.
Okay, well, are you talking about IRAs or are we talking about more sophisticated retirement plans?
We're talking about retirement plans that are set up under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, which in normal human speak, that basically means any retirement plan that's set up by an employer in the private sector.
Mm-hmm. And it also is known as ERISA, right?
Correct. That's right.
So sometimes you're looking at your brokerage statements or your investment advisor agreements, and it says something about ERISA. So this is a particular area of the law that has to do with pension plans that are run by private companies.
Exactly.
Okay. So why are quadros so complicated?
Quadros are complicated not because court orders are complicated. They're complicated because the subject matter of retirement plans is complicated. Most people probably know about as much about their retirement plans to the extent that they can identify what they have. They can say, I have a 401k or I have a defined benefit pension plan, but that's about all they really know about what they have. So What makes the orders complicated is that you have to get very specific about what the plan is and how it's being divided.
And what about the division? I mean, if I have a plan that has a certain amount of assets, why can't I just divide it in half?
The plans are creditor protected. So whereas something like a checking account, let's say you look at your checking account on one day and it has $100,000 in it, unless you go and take a withdrawal, odds are there's still going to be $100,000 in it tomorrow. With something like a 401k,
okay,
even though it has a cash balance, it's not actually a cash account. It's a collection of fairly complicated investments, right?
Right.
And it's going to be worth something different 2 hours from now than it's worth right now. So categorizing what it is and how it's being divided and when it's going to be divided can get pretty tricky because, quite frankly, there isn't that much understanding of what the asset is.
Give me an example of a particularly interesting case that you've come across in your career.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of them. Not surprisingly, in the family law context, I've seen a lot of interesting ones. But one of the ones that I came into very early in my career, there was a case where a woman was getting a divorce and she had two kids and her husband was a pilot. And he made about $200,000 a year and he refused to pay any child support. He refused to pay any alimony. He wouldn't pay for the house. He basically abandoned everybody and left. So when the woman came to us, she obviously was in dire need of money. And when we went to court, the judge was absolutely irate with this gentleman for not making payments as he was supposed to be. And the judge wanted to throw him in jail. And rather than have him thrown in jail, we actually asked the judge to enter a quadro for the entire balance of his 401k, which was about $400,000. And the judge was willing to sign that order, and the plan actually took the entire account and assigned it to her. So essentially what we did in that case is we used the quadro as an enforcement mechanism for a non-compliant person.
A qualified domestic relations order, and that's where that term really comes from, right?
Exactly.
So that is a very good example. So in one case, and this is an extreme case, so it does, I think, go to define the question very well and the answer. But in most cases, you know, I am interested in this factor that if a certain point during the divorce, the assets, the plan assets, let's say it's 2007, and the plan assets are worth $500,000.
Right.
And by mid-2008,
right,
you know, they're worth $250,000. What kind of thinking goes on there?
Typically, depending on what state you're in, those are called passive gains and losses. That's the technical speak in family law. The passive gains and losses on that money means the market fluctuations. People typically share on a pro rata basis those market gains and losses. So if it was worth $200,000 and it dipped to $150,000 and each party was entitled to half, that means each party would eat $25,000 of loss in that case.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. I think the difference here and maybe some of the problems that someone can run into is if they decide to cash out when the market is way down. Now you're splitting cash. Now you've kind of got a bit of a problem.
Well, and so that really gives you a clear understanding of why there needs to be some kind of financial professional being consulted during the process of the divorce, because you want to time that transfer as best as possible so that you don't receive the minimal amount of money during your divorce if somebody's going through that.
My guest is Matthew Lundy. He's, as you can see, he's an attorney who specializes in this particular area of divorce, called the Qualified Domestic Relations Order. And if you unfortunately have been in a divorce or contemplating one and you ask your attorney to start asking questions about your pension plan, he's going to stop you and he's going to say, go seek another professional. They don't really want to get involved in that.
That's true.
I do remember that myself. So once again, you know, if you have some financial advice, perhaps that person would tell you, don't cash out. If you own shares of XYZ, you still own those shares, split the shares, not necessarily the value.
That's right.
Would that be an acceptable way to think about it?
I think that's probably, in a lot of cases, a very acceptable way to think about it.
So again, there's this timing issue. Are there certain benchmarks or rules as to when this date should be set to actually split the assets?
Well, it really depends. Family law is sort of a very flexible creature in some ways. It can be whenever the parties agree, to the extent that they're going to agree. If they don't agree and they ended up having a trial, then it would typically be the date that their case is filed in most states.
You know, Matt, we talked about 401ks. Those are defined as defined contribution plans. What about defined benefit plans? Those are a lot more complicated. How do you split those up? Because it's not really a bucket of money you're talking about. It's a future benefit.
Correct. Defined benefit plans are probably considered one of the five most complicated assets that people run into in family law cases, right up there with businesses that people own that have to be valued. It's not a simple answer. When somebody has a defined benefit plan, I find that they virtually don't understand what they have at all.
Sure.
So if you say to most people, what is a defined benefit plan, they won't really be able to answer that question very clearly. And just so your listeners understand, a defined benefit plan, it ultimately turns into some kind of annuity when you reach a minimum age of retirement. So Social Security is a defined benefit plan. You can start drawing on it when you turn 62, which would be an early draw on your Social Security. But the regular age to draw on it is 66. So you can receive a reduced amount at 62, but the regular amount is at 66. What does it include? It includes a stream of income, so that's something that would be divided. It includes a cost of living adjustment, which is an increase, a periodic increase, that's intended to reflect the consumer price index. It'll include a survivor benefit. And in the case of a private sector pension, they offer certain early retirement supplements, which can be sort of complicated. So when you run into one of those, the deal is you need to be as specific as possible. It's another reason that an attorney like me exists, so that I can come in and say, okay, legally, this is how this particular asset is divided. And these are the 10 things that we need to address when we approach a defined benefit pension plan.
My guest, Matthew Lundy, is an attorney specializing in qualified domestic relations orders or quadros, and it's involved in divorce. More information about Matt can be found at mlundy, L-U-N-D-Y, mlundylaw.com, and he's located in Boca Raton. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt.
Thank you very much. It was great being here. I appreciate it.
This week on the On the Money Minute, are annuities worth it? Hi, Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. Well, our question this week are whether annuities are worth it or not. And my answer is a plain old, it depends. And it really does. For example, what stage of life are you in now? Are you at the point where you need immediate income? Are you concerned with outliving your assets? Remember, Social Security pays you for as long as you live, as do defined benefit pension plans. But an immediate annuity, for example, is a source of income to you that will pay you out indefinitely for as long as you live. They can also help protect your assets from creditors, which can be a good thing in the event of any legal issues. So, an immediate annuity can be beneficial in some circumstances. Get it? Okay, more tomorrow. If you want more On the Money, don't forget to follow us at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com, or facebook.com/The Steve Pomeranz Show. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. People can talk about love. People can talk about money. The really hard thing is to talk about the two topics together, especially when getting married or moving in together. So says my next guest and co-author of The New Love Deal, Everything You Must Know Before Marrying, Moving In, and Moving On. Cleverly, the book gives the perspectives of three well-regarded experts: Gemma Allen, a prominent family attorney, Judge Michelle Lawrence, a longtime judge in divorce division, and Terry Savage, the famed financial writer and money advisor, who is with me right now. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Delighted to be back.
It's a great concept, looking at this phenomenon from three separate directions. You know, the implied marriage contract is changing. In what ways is it changing?
Well, we come to marriage at a different stage, at many different stages now than what your parents, maybe for if you're younger, what your grandparents did. Where they were young, they got married, they planned to live happily ever after. It didn't always work out, but in an era that there was maybe more sense of responsibility to stay together and stick it out until at least the kids were out of the house. Now we look at marriage and living together completely differently. I mean, there's no more concept of living in sin, because people routinely move in together, even if they're not just planning a wedding next month and decided to move in now. People come to our relationships with more. They already have jobs. They might have savings or assets built up. And both parties are more likely to have incomes. And some have obligations like child support from a previous relationship or marriage or student loans. So how you handle your money and how open you are with your partner is going to have a big impact on how successful your relationship will be.
So there are legal guidelines for all these things. Have the legal guidelines kept pace with these changes?
You know, it's very interesting. Some of the myths that we had around agreements like prenuptial agreements, the wealthy older guy and the young gold digger signing away her future life, That's not the case anymore. Now we have prenuptial agreements signed by people who might have decisions like, well, we're not going to pay child support out of our joint household money, or we are going to save together, but each one has a different income, so we're going to do this proportionately. These are the kinds of issues that come up in a marriage. And if you're older, issues like, you know, I love you, dear, but I have two grown children. I want to take care of you as long as I can, but I want to make sure my kids, adult kids, aren't waiting around for you to die before they get my estate. Mm-hmm. The adult kids are happy to hear that there's an agreement like that, too. And then there's just people living together, you know. That's a different kind of agreement.
Yeah, but you know, you make it sound so natural that it's an easy discussion to have. But I think you know as well as I do that actually sitting down and starting to talk about money issues is a very difficult thing to do. It's a bit of a taboo, especially for the older generation.
That is exactly why we wrote The New Love Deal. It is there. The first part of it explains how you get this discussion started, and it can start with opening the book to the chapter on starting to talk about it. First of all, let's dispel this myth that being honest and open and loving and discussing financial issues is a romance buzz buster.
Yeah.
The fact is, it is the essence of true love and romance, because if you love this person enough to share not only your finances, your assets and liabilities, but your emotional concerns, your fears, if you're a woman, maybe about being a bag lady because you watched your mother in that situation, your fears, if you're a man, because your younger brother got divorced and his wife took him for everything. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to share those concerns and then work on a plan together that respects each other's feelings, then you can come to the nuts and bolts of an agreement that you need lawyers for. But it's first the discussion.
So it's the art of communication, really, and how you frame things. But here's a line that you wrote. One way to start the conversation is to swap credit reports, preferably over a nice bottle of wine. I don't think there's any amount of wine I could drink where I would really feel good about swapping my credit report.
Well, if you want to just jump in, you know, there's people who tiptoe in, and for that we have candlelit dinners and a suggested list of basic emotional feeler questions and ways to respond. Yeah. But if you're one of those person that will really just jump off the diving board and land right in the pool, I think that's a great idea. You know, it's so easy. You cannot get a loved one's credit report because there are a lot of questions that even you don't know about his or her past purchases and so forth that require to identify you online. But you can go online and each pull your own credit report. And if you're unwilling to share that with the person that you care about, what else is he or she unwilling to share with you? It doesn't tell everything you own, but it does show your payment history. It shows if you've had financial problems and credit problems in the past. You're marrying, especially if you're marrying, this person's credit report, as well as her beautiful blue eyes or his strong shoulders.
Yeah.
And this is going to impact your life together.
Yeah.
Which, how sad when people find out that, okay, we're happily married and let's go get a house. I'm sorry. Susie had declared bankruptcy and had all these bad credit reports. So her name can't be on the title. She can't be on the mortgage.
Right. The book is The New Love Deal, Everything You Must Know Before Marrying, Moving In, or Moving On. My guest, of course, is Terry Savage, well-known author and investment specialist. So we're talking about the discussion before marriage, but you know, so many people are cohabitating these days. They're living together. Is the conversation any different?
You know, the results are different. The conversation isn't necessarily that different. For a prenup to be valid, when you make this agreement, each has to be separately represented and must make full disclosure of all assets and liabilities. That makes a prenup valid. And it's ever, if it does have to get litigated or resolved in divorce at some point in the future, that's done in family court or whatever your state labels that court. Now, just living together brings up a host of different issues that mostly revolve around money. I mean, you're moving into her condo and you're contributing half the money every month.
Mm-hmm.
If your name isn't on the mortgage, you don't retitle it. Then you wind up with receipts for electric bills, and she's building up the equity value in the condo. So you need a civil agreement, a cohabitation agreement, and it would be, if ever, litigated in civil courts without some of the protections of the family court. But just merely the discussion about how you're going to share your money. It's her condo, her mortgage. Does she pay more? Does she make the mortgage payment? You make the electric bills? What happens to your credit if something happens with the condo? So there are a lot of things, and we have a whole list of them to discuss, that are covered by a cohabitation agreement. And you can do that with one attorney because it doesn't require separate attorneys, but it probably would be better so that you can, if you go to court over it in the future, you can have your own defense.
So let's say the arrangement, the agreements are set, years go by, and as always, situations change. And I don't mean the relationship, but maybe one person makes more money or experiences an inheritance, some kind of windfall or some kind of a loss. Is there a point in time when these agreements should be recalibrated?
Yeah, that may often happen. Now, just so we clear it up, it's part of your question, you mentioned an inheritance. And an inheritance, no matter what your prenup, unless you specifically put the money from your inheritance in joint name in a house together, you buy a vacation home together, an inheritance always by law remains the property of the beneficiary, the person who inherited the money. You can waive that, by, as I say, by saying, oh, great, Grandpa just left me $250,000. We can buy the cottage on the lake, put it in joint name. Now it's marital property.
Mm-hmm.
Again, state laws apply how marital property is divided. But to the point of things change, sure, someone might decide to stay home. And a lot of times it's men these days to raise the children. You can readjust and have a postnuptial agreement. We explain about those. So maybe you want to cover things like, well, Joe's staying home with the babies because Sally's got a great job moving right up the executive ranks, but Sally ought to be contributing to a spousal IRA for Joe who's home with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Those IRAs remain individual property, but the money that you make as a couple, you have to decide how you're going to spend it, how you're going to save it, how you're going to invest it. And believe me, there are two kinds of people in the world, the savers and the spenders. For better or for worse, they tend to marry each other. And right away, you have problems if you don't discuss it and then come up with an automatic plan that avoids the fights and then adjust the plan as your life circumstances change.
Yeah, so let's talk about the plan. You know, there's the day-to-day issues. Who's going to handle the daily living expenses, the bank accounts? How is property going to be titled? Let's get into some of the details there. What are some of these day-to-day and longer-term considerations that we need to talk about?
What we hope is that parents who've learned these lessons the hard way will be giving the new love deal to their 20-somethings who are now getting married or moving in together for the first time, because that's the most difficult step to organize. And you both have incomes. The question is, first of all, are you going to share everything, put all your money in the same checking account and the same savings account? That may or may not work. Maybe you each get a direct deposit of your paycheck into your own checking account. And at the same time, the next day, you're paid on the 1st and the 15th, one of those days, an automatic transfer into the joint checking account, out of which you pay your electric bills and cell phone bills and rent or mortgage out of that joint account, leaving you with money of your own. So he doesn't know that you spent that much on the dress, or she doesn't know that what you paid for the birthday present.
So are you a saver or a spender? From that last statement, I'm not sure anymore.
Well, the point is, by the time you reach the stage in life where you're ready to tie yourself to another person in a love relationship, whichever you are, nobody can change. It's hard enough to change yourself,
yeah,
much less your partner.
True. That's true.
So I'm a mix. I've learned over the years to set up the discipline of having the money taken out automatically before you see it and spend it. You know, take a look at your paycheck. There's that big box marked FICA, Social Security. It stands for Federal Insurance Contributions Act. I always thought a contribution was voluntary. I guarantee you can't go up into the HR department and say, I have a lot of bills this month. I don't think I can afford to make that contribution to FICA, so just leave that, So I think every individual should automatically have an amount of at least 50% of FICA. That's a lot of money. Taken out and put automatically into the 401k, get the match, or an IRA. If you set up these systems so that you don't have to debate, it's just gone. If you don't see it, you can't spend it. Then you don't have to have the discussion and the emotional agony. Same thing in a marriage. Set up a plan and make sure it happens automatically, and you don't have to deal with it every month.
The book is The New Love Deal, Everything You Must Know Before Marrying, Moving In, and Moving On. The co-author is Terry Savage, who you've just been listening to, and she also has two other authors, a judge and a divorce attorney, and they all mix their ideas together and give you a comprehensive look at things that you should and should not be doing. Terry, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
I thank you for having us on, and I hope everybody finds something of interest in The New Love Deal.
The New Love Deal. Thank you, Terry. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So homes are selling quickly nationwide. How long does it take now for the average house to stay on the market that's for sale?
Nationally, Steve, this is crazy. 27 days was reported for the month of May.
Wow, less than a month.
Yeah, that's insane. Now, in Florida, we're a little sluggish. We're, say, 46 to 60 days.
Whose fault is that? Is that your fault?
Absolutely. I'm sure we have something to do with it. No, I think we just price them a little higher than the rest of the country. So we keep them on the market a little longer.
Okay. But 27 days, I remember during the crisis, homes were on the market for 100 and something days.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow. So
yep,
we are on the other side of that cycle, that's for sure.
And basically the bottom line is this, buyer's demand is still increasing and our inventory of home availability for sale remains low. So that's what's pushing the number of days on market.
Well, let's get to that. Who's to blame for the fact that homes are not being listed for sale?
Is it the, what's the expression? What came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah.
I'm going to blame the sellers.
Okay. So if it's the sellers, what age group is holding the market back here? Who's to blame?
It's always the baby boomers.
Why?
Because we're the largest group of people.
Yeah. But why aren't we selling as a group?
Well, what you have to understand is the number one reason why people sell is lifestyle changes.
Mm-hmm.
A baby is born, a divorce. You become older and you need to downsize. So what's happened is, you go back to when the market softened, a lot of the people, bought their homes. Maybe it's their second, third home. They're comfortable in this house because this recession started in 2008, 2007, mm-hmm. 2006. So it's a good 10, 12 years that this has been going on. So now you're in your house and it's comfortable. It's not really too big.
Mm-hmm.
You're acquiring money in the house now. We are in a negative equity situation for, long period of time. Now the majority of the people are in a positive equity situation. The baby boomers, if they're going to make a move, for the most part, are looking to make a downward move, not an upward move.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're moving downward, now you're competing against the first-time home buyers and the millennials. So it's just a trickle-down effect. You just don't have the inventory. The baby boomers are one of the driving forces behind it. They're comfortable with where they're at, and they're not moving for now.
Well, I think good realtors are partly to blame, too, because you guys are selling houses that people like.
Yeah.
And they're comfortable in and they're sticking. So I don't know. It reminds me of those days where they used to say the car manufacturers used to build cars for planned obsolescence so they'd only last so many years so they could keep turning these cars over. You guys are just doing the right thing and people are staying.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know what the average turnover rate used to be or is today?
What's that?
Well, right now, though, it was 6 years.
Meaning that the average time a person stayed in a house was 6 years.
Right, prior to 2008. Now we're up to 9 years, which is, you know, doesn't sound like that much, but that's a 50% increase in time.
When I got into the business 30 plus years ago, I did a lot of bond work, a lot of Ginnie Mae mortgages, and we used to always say that the average time was 7 years that a mortgage would last, meaning people would sell their houses on average around 7 years. This report says 6 years, but now that is extended to 9. But I think a lot of that is because of 08. People have been stuck in their homes for so long, it's extended the period. I think it's going to go back down to 6 or 7 years.
It will. Yeah. It will.
Okay. Hey, listen, there is an email scam out there that we need to tell the listeners about.
Yeah, this is huge. There's a story that just came out of a family who was involved in a real estate transaction, and they received wiring instructions from the title company. They received an email that said, you know, okay, now it's time to wire over an additional $1.3 million on the purchase of your home.
Yeah.
So they actually went so far as to call the phone number that was given to them on the email, and they said, yep, that's right, go ahead and send the money, and they did. But unfortunately, it was sent to a wrong person. Basically, somebody hacked into the title company's email, stole the information, reached out to this buyer, and sent him the wiring instruction information. So this poor buyer thinks he's doing the right thing by calling the phone number that's given to him on the email to verify that it's okay to send this additional amount of money. But in reality, he did the wrong thing. What he really should have done, and this is the warning to all the listeners, if you're wiring money, don't look at the email and call the phone number that it's providing you. Call the known number that you have in a different, you know, different email, different source to verify that this is indeed the right place to be sending the money to.
Are the title companies doing anything to fix this problem, to prevent it from happening?
Real estate companies, title companies, a lot of them now send you encrypted emails where you have to have the password to open up the link to give you that information. So if you're getting a regular email, well, I don't even want to say that because there's so many different kinds of scams.
Yeah.
Bottom line is always make a phone call to your known title person or verify with your real estate that you're calling the right title person. Your real estate agent shouldn't be providing you the wiring instructions. It should be coming from the person who's sending it to you.
Yeah.
But make sure you're calling and speaking to the right person. Just don't randomly call and accept anyone's word that, oh yeah, that's the right place to be sending it
to. Yeah, distrust your emails because things are being hacked. You know, sites are being hacked all the time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I was speaking with some potential clients the other day as they were doing their due diligence to choose an advisor, and they mentioned to me that one advisor that they had talked with had recommended structured settlements as a good investment. Now, that's not something you hear about every day, but, you know, so when something like that comes to my attention, I thought, aha, this would be a good segment for the show to find out more about structured investments and to help everybody understand them. So I called a thought leader in our industry, Larry Swedrow, to talk about these with me. He had written an article some years ago about that. Larry is director of research at the BAM Alliance, which is a large RIA located in St. Louis, and he's well known in the industry. And he's the author or co-author of 13 books on investments and planning, including his most recent book, Think, Act, and Invest Like Warren Buffett. Hey, Larry, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
So let's get into this. I said this term structured settlement. What is a structured settlement?
Well, what can happen is, say, Steve, you are in a automobile accident, you get hit by a truck, and the insurance company offers, you know, you a settlement and to pay it out over a long period of time. Now you've got that, and now you decide you'd rather have the cash up front. Mm-hmm. So somebody, in effect, pays you the cash, and now they own that, you know, structured settlement, that series of cash flows. And they, of course, want to profit from that, and they look for retail investors who are willing to pay, say, a higher price than they did. And so that's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You're buying basically a stream of income. Typically, it may be, say, for 20 years. It's not a for life. And you have the credit risk of the insurance company, who is typically the backer.
All right. Well, let's get into that in a minute. So this is kind of like the lottery in a sense, you know, how you can get a lump sum or you can get these cash flows throughout 20 years or a lifetime. Let's take 20 years as an example. So let's say a person in this case has an accident and gets these cash flows. They decide, hey, I'm sick of the cash flows. I want the money. I want as much money as I can in a lump sum. So along comes an investor, and then they buy this from the insurance company. They pay a certain lump sum,
right,
which they give to the owner of the policy, so to speak. And then they kind of mark it up, and then they sell it to retail investors. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The question you might ask is, if it's such a good deal, why is it being offered to you? Why isn't, you know, Goldman Sachs buying it and putting it in their portfolio?
That's right.
Generally, a good way to think about these things.
Yeah.
What makes you so special? If it's so good, why isn't the Yale Endowment investing in this?
Yeah.
A really smart, sophisticated investor.
Yeah, good point. That's an excellent point. Now, these kinds of investments seem attractive because the amount of cash flow you get is relatively high relative to safe investments like treasuries and CDs. Isn't that accurate? And if so, why is the yield so much higher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly the yield's going to be higher, and it's going to be higher for a few reasons. First of all, there is credit risk you're accepting here because you're getting that cash flow from an insurance company. So the comparison that you should make should not be with treasuries or CDs, but let's just use a particular name, let's say Prudential Insurance. If that's the issuer here, you're taking their credit risk. And let's assume it was a 20-year structure, what you should do is look to see what interest rate you could earn by buying a Prudential 20-year bond, or better, because it would be safer, at least it would be diversified, buy a mutual fund that owns, you know, lots of bonds with the same, let's say, AA credit rating.
Right.
And that's the comparison I would make. But even then, you should get a large premium above that. By that, I mean a higher yield, because if the mutual fund you bought that, you would have daily liquidity, number one. So if emergencies came up, you could sell it and get it liquid. Second thing is, if it was in a taxable account, if rates went up, you could harvest and take a loss on it, while if you own this structured settlement, from Prudential, it's totally illiquid.
Yeah.
Nothing you pretty much could do with that without taking a very large loss in a secondary market transaction, which means you're also then losing this ability to harvest losses that you get with a mutual fund. So that's why the yields are higher.
Yeah.
And in general, my rule of thumb is this. If you hear the word structured note or structured settlement, you should run extremely quickly away because you could be certain the structure is done in a way that it benefits the issuer and not the buyer. And the reason that's all you need to know is that if Prudential could raise money at a lower cost of capital, it would sell a bond directly.
Yeah. All right. I want to get back to this term liquidity because this is vitally important when investing. So, you know, there's good and bad of everything, right? One of the good things about having a liquid bond market, having a bond market where you can buy and sell bonds all the time or stocks all the time, is that you could get to turn this investment into cash on a given day at a given price. The price isn't necessarily guaranteed, but the ability to turn it into cash is, I wouldn't say guaranteed, but it's very, very high probability that you'll be able to do that. When you're dealing with these structured investments, you're basically stuck for the whole period of time. So you better be sure that you can handle not having this lump sum back for 20 years in case there's an emergency or some kind of event that was unforeseen. Now, you mentioned that you could sell these in a secondary market, meaning that there are buyers who will come in and buy this from you, but it's not a very well-developed secondary market, so the price you'll get will most likely be much lower than it's really, really worth. So in effect, you still lack that liquidity we're talking about. So when you don't have liquidity, you should expect a higher yield because there's never a case where you get something for nothing. If the yield is higher, there's got to be some catch. You want to add to that at all?
No, basically, that's exactly right. Now, that doesn't mean you should never invest any of your money in a less liquid asset. Yale Endowment knows it's not likely to spend more than, say, 6 or 7% in any 1 year. So it can take some portion of its portfolio, maybe 20 or 30%, and invest it in highly illiquid investments, like a rubber plantation, say, in Indonesia, that won't pay out for 20 years as the trees grow. But they can do that. Now, if you have ability to put some small portion of your portfolio in a very illiquid investment, you might consider it. But in this case, I don't believe you'll ever find that it will be attractive for the reasons I gave you, and the cost to get it, you know, out of it isn't going to be like 1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. It might be 8 or even 10% if you could get out.
Right.
So I would say for most investors, this is not a good illiquid investment. There are ones that actually we do recommend and I personally invest in.
So finally, this falls under the fixed income category of your investment portfolio. They're bond-like. So I think the idea, though, that is the bond part of your portfolio should be the safe part of your portfolio. So in a sense, this investment also may violate that tenet of correct investing. Would you agree with that?
There are many people who have a different opinion, Steve, but you and I are on the same page. And I wrote a book, The Only Guide You'll Ever Need for Fixed Income Investing. And in there, we state, my co-author and I, that we believe that bonds should be the safe portion, as you stated. In other words, you want to have a sufficient amount of safe bonds that will do well generally when equities are doing poorly. So it adds stability to your portfolio and doesn't allow your portfolio to experience a greater loss than your stomach can handle. In that case, you panic and sell.
Right.
And so what I point out is in 2008, while things like high yield bonds, preferred stocks, junk bonds, emerging market bonds, REITs, all have higher yields than the safe treasuries or AA, AAA rated municipal bonds we recommend, In 08, they went down from as little as about 25% to as much as 60 or 70%, while the safe bonds we bought were generally up in the low double digits. That's a huge benefit when your equities are dropping 40 to 60%.
Good point.
So we would never recommend investing in products such as these.
My guest is Larry Swedrow, Director of Research for the BAM Alliance. Larry, let's switch gears here because I love to talk about investments, and I know you do as well. I know you're a strong proponent of index investing, as am I. So I want to get into that in a second, but what I want to talk about is this fact that I keep getting calls from clients who just really feel like they want to cash out because they read articles about the market being very, very overvalued or too risky because of the current politics. And they want to know, you know, should I get out? Can I get out before the market goes down? You know, Steve, can I go to cash now? We've made all this money. Can I go to cash now? Do you think the market is too overvalued, Larry?
Great question. And it's actually one I address, Steve, in my column on ETF.com, so the readers could find it there. It's an August 23rd piece, and it's called Wait and You'll Likely Miss Out. So let's first address the issue that going back to as far back as 2013, we had people like Jeremy Grantham and John Husband, two well-known gurus, saying the market was as much as 60 to 70% overvalued, and they were wanting you to get out. And obviously, if you got out, you missed pretty good returns over the last 4 years. There is no one that I'm aware of who has a clear crystal ball and has a good track record on market timing. That's what the research shows. But I would add this. Would you rather listen, Steve? Who do you think your listeners should listen to? Gurus on CNBC or Warren Buffett when it comes to investment advice?
Hang on. Let me think about that. Yeah. So obviously, we know Warren Buffett is the answer. What does Warren Buffett say about that?
Right. And here's the great anomaly that people idolize Buffett, and most people actually not only ignore his advice, they do exactly the opposite. And Buffett has said he hasn't even read or listen to economic or market forecast in 25 years because he knows they have absolutely no value and they tell you nothing about where the market is going, though they tell you a lot about the person. So let's just touch briefly on this. There was an interesting study that was done, which I wrote up on the paper. So let's assume you're convinced we're going to get a 10% correction and you believe it's going to happen in the next 3 years. And by the way, that happens 54% of the time that in any three-year period, you will get at least a 10% correction. And if you're right, but you get out now, you benefit 10% by doing so. That's the average benefit.
Okay.
On the other hand, there's 46% of the time, my memory serves, that you're incorrect. And when you're wrong, you lose on average 30%. Okay, so clearly on a risk-adjusted basis, you're way better off staying invested because, you know, roughly it's 50-50, but when you're right, you make 10%, and when you're wrong, you miss out on 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you can get a 10% correction, but not from today's levels. I'm sure Grantham and Hussman would eventually be proven right, like a broken clock that's right twice a day, but they're going to be four or more years too early, and they missed out.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because Grantham just changed his tune, and he says that he's now bullish on stocks, and he's been a bear. And I have to be honest about Hussman. I followed him for a long time. This guy is always bearish, and I can't imagine that he's made any money during the years because he's never in the market, you know, according to what he says in his writings. So I guess the idea is, look, we can't foretell the future, but we know that internally, the companies that are sitting in these indexes over time, on average, are creating more wealth for themselves and for their shareholders. And eventually that gets reflected in the price of their stock. And if you average all of that, all the winners and the losers, by staying with a, you know, plain old index with low expenses, you're going to capture that. And those returns over time have shown and will probably continue to be superior to those of fixed income investments.
You sound almost like Warren Buffett there, Steve. Let me just add this. While the U.S. market is highly valued, if you make proper adjustments to the earnings numbers, which I've written about on my blogs at ETF.com, they are really only about 10 or 15% above appropriate adjusted historical levels. And given the exceptionally low level of interest rates, stocks don't look that expensive to me. They look highly valued, but not out of the realm of reason like we were in 1999, early 2000. But I would add this. While U.S. stocks are more expensive than their historical average, international stocks are no more expensive and may be cheaper. And certainly that's been the case also for emerging markets. And investors, unfortunately, tend to dramatically underweight those. And that's a big mistake, a home country bias.
Mm-hmm.
My personal recommendation is 50% U.S. and 50% international. And of the 50% international, I would have 3/8 developed and 1/8 emerging. And the reason is that's how the global market capitalization works out. And I don't think I'm any smarter than the markets in general. And I don't believe there is anyone else out there.
Larry, we've got to stop you there. We are out of time. My guest, Larry Swedrow, Director of Research for the BAM Alliance. If you have any questions or any comments and you'd like to get in touch with us, don't forget to find us at stevepomerantz.com. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for taking your time.
My pleasure, Steve.
You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.